The Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Blackshaw Arts Hour. I'm Ellie, and I am joined by two wonderful people at the moment, probably due to be another person arriving later. No, Matt Breedman's not giving birth, but Vicky Weston will be joining us later. Good. So, Matt, hello.
I am here, though.
Hi, welcome. And we've also got the lovely Sinead with us today.
Hello.
Hi. So, up on the show today, we have got a split film review. It's a triplet film review.
Yeah, because we haven't done one in a few weeks, so
that's
lots
right.
of stuff's been out.
So we thought we'd not only do one, not two, but three.
Yep.
We've also got an update from Sinead on her theatre challenge and some other shows that she has seen. Vicky will be talking to us about Girl from the North Country, which is on at the Old Vic. We'll be telling you more about our upcoming Scare Slam. So, let's kick it all off, Matt, with the thing that we usually kick things off with.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
What are you reviewing for us today?
So, I mean, the real question is, what do you want me to talk about first?
I thought you were going to say, what aren't I reviewing for you today? Should we go alphabetical order?
Oh, yeah, that seems a very fair
How
way
unconventional.
Of doing it. Yeah. I think that automatically takes it also in the order that I saw them.
Oh, lovely. Well, that's maybe easier for your brain.
Yeah, so which means Atomic Blonde first.
Yes.
Which you've also seen.
I have also seen.
Yeah, so which is a movie set in at the tail end of the Cold War in Berlin, based on a comic book called The Coldest City, starring Charlize Theron, who we know that we like as an action heroine. We've talked about her before ages ago when we talked about Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, which I still haven't seen, by the way.
Yeah, she's got a lot more. She's got more hair in this one.
Right,
she's
good.
She's not bald this time. Got both her arms this time.
Excellent.
Still punchy, kicky.
Very punchy,
fierce.
Kicky.
Still quite stoic as well. Like,
yes.
Quite sort of quiet and like stony and
she's quite
reserved.
Weathered.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And gets beaten up a lot. So she is an agent sent to Berlin to retrieve. A list of covert identities of agents operating on all sides of the Cold War, which if it got into the wrong hands, lots of people would get hunted down and killed.
Yeah, because they'd work out who they were for reals.
Yeah, and she may have some sort of personal stake in the story as well. Maybe, we don't know. She's quite mysterious and inscrutable.
Yes.
So it's this. Really kind of bright neon drenched look to the movie. It's sort of it paints a picture of Berlin at that time as a very, very punk place.
Yeah,
lots of neon, lots of graffiti, lots of like studded leather and
against a really grey backdrop
hair. Yeah, against like the very grey backdrop when they cross over into East Berlin over the wall. What I took from it is it's a story about you get that far into that sort of covert espionage conflict and it becomes all about just spies playing games among themselves. And it feels very much like the consequences that they're racing to avert are consequences for other spies. And it's like they've all lost any sense that they're actually working towards doing any good for anybody else outside that espionage community. It's
yeah,
just about protecting their own.
It kind of doesn't really matter what country they're from either. It's just kind of about, yeah, sort of individual spies rather than the bigger picture.
Yeah, it's like this sort of parallel covert world that where everything else that's going on, all the sort of the fall of the wall and the punks rising up and all that sort of thing, feels like to the characters, it's a setting or a backdrop rather than the context of the spycraft that they're doing.
Yeah.
Like they've sort of lost touch with it and it's all just about protecting their own necks.
Yeah, it's almost like Berlin Wall, whatever, I've got more important things to be doing.
Yeah. How do I stop people finding out who I really am and taking me out?
Yeah.
Lots of cool fights.
so many cool fights. Yeah.
I felt like it took a little while to find its feet, like in the first act, not just in a couple of different ways. So first of all, in kind of the fighting scenes, the first few felt to me quite like obviously choreographed, like mm-hmm. they didn't feel like you could kind of sense the intent behind the moves. Like it wasn't sort of, oh, that person is trying to hurt her and she is defending herself in these ways. It was like, that's the next move in the sequence of the fight that has been choreographed. Yeah. But that picks up later on and we get some stuff that actually approaches like the gold standard of sort of the Paul Greengrass Bourne movies.
Yeah, well, I think partly it's what you're saying is as well that you can see the motivation much more clearly as it goes on, and the desperation, and she has to become more inventive. Like, it does seem quite planned and, oh, I've got this that I can use, whereas it really is that she's fighting for her life and grabbing whatever she can, and she becomes more and more injured as time goes on as well, so that makes it more interesting.
Yes, there's one really standout fight scene in a sort of abandoned hotel room with Eddie Marzan standing on the sidelines looking on, increasingly sort of incredulous as the two of them sort of are reaching for any old household thing or stuff in their pockets to beat each other up with. But also sort of in the first act, I felt like I was getting worried in the first act that the movie wasn't really going to be about her, that she was going to be a sort of emotional blank and it was then going to be all about all of the other characters. Like, it felt like it was much more interested in the motivations of, say, James McAvoy's character, who is another British spy who's sort of gone native in Berlin and has maybe sort of lost his way and lost his morals a little bit. Which is, it's all kind of a function of the fact that the film is withholding certain information about Charlize Theron's character for the sake of some mysteries and some twists later on.
Yeah, and it's all kind of intercut with her being interviewed back in the UK after her mission's completed, which adds to the sort of confusion about what her motives are, about what really happened, because you're not sure if she's a reliable narrator, if what she's telling them is actually what happened. And then it's intercut with what actually happened. And
Yeah, so I felt like it stuck the landing. But if you're watching it, you do have to give it some slack in the first act and sort of trust that it's going to pick it up later on, I think.
Yeah.
But overall, I really liked the look of it. Mm. And it did feel like it was a bit of a different feel to a espionage, spycraft sort of movie. Like it... Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, it ain't.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't really like that. I didn't like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy very much. It was too slow for me. So I'm glad it ain't.
Yeah, if you thought Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was too slow, this one is not.
Yeah, it's
much
not.
Brighter and much faster.
It's more pretty pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not hugely clever, but it was brilliant, I think. I thought it was. And I liked that it didn't feel like they'd gone, oh, we need to create a role for a woman to be a lead. It felt like it was a story and it could have been a man or a woman playing Charlize Theron's role. And I think, unless I'm misremembering, there weren't really any bits where I thought, oh, well, this would never work if...
No. Yeah, I agree with that.
Which was nice for a change.
Yeah, because I think there was some publicity billing it as like... because there was a lot of conversation going on about, could you have a black Bond? Could you have a female Bond?
Yeah.
And it was like, well, we don't need a female Bond because we've got this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Which I'm sure was good for marketing.
Yeah. It reduces the issue and oversimplifies things.
Yeah.
But if it got people in to see it when they might not otherwise have done.
I'd say it was definitely more of a female Bourne than a female Bond.
Yeah.
Though. It's definitely more Bourne-y than Bondy.
Yep.
Yeah, it was good. Recommend.
Yep, agree.
Good.
Next.
Well, if we're going alphabetically.
Yeah, that means Dark Tower next.
Correct, which I have not seen.
Okay, so this is the big screen adaptation of Stephen King's Dark Tower book series, book and comic and general kind of cross-media series.
Oh, so it
series.
Is a comic, because I thought it was a graphic novel.
Yeah, it was books first.
Yeah.
And then there are graphic novels, which I think are... tie-ins rather than adaptations of the books,
and
so I think it's different.
And Atomic
stories.
Blonde was based on a graphic novel as well.
It was, yeah, Coldest City.
Okay.
And there's a planned Dark Tower TV series as well that fits alongside the movie.
Will it be the same people in it?
Apparently Idris Elba's in it.
Yes,
so Idris Elba's in this movie.
That's
always
good news.
Yeah, exactly. Always welcome news.
Yeah, Idris Elba opposite Matthew McConaughey as a bad guy. He's very good, actually, Matthew McConaughey, as a sinister villain.
Yeah, see, the thing is, he's very capable. I just think he doesn't always choose the best roles.
He's been... It was Kermode, wasn't it, who coined the McConaissance.
Oh, nice.
He had a period of doing rom-coms where he was leaning on a car in all the posters.
Yes, and then he went mad and retreated to be a hippie for a while.
Yeah, and then he came back with things like Dallas Buyers Club, Inception, he was very good in.
Yeah, that detective
Not Inception,
series.
Sorry.
The did I miss that?
Yeah, no, the Interstellar. Also, Chris Nolan also starts with an I.
Yeah.
And the detective thing.
True Detective.
Yes.
Yeah. He's sort of very gaunt, but quite charismatic.
Does he wear a long
the
coat?
The Man in Black. No, he wears very sort of stylishly tailored black suit.
Oh, okay.
Sort of get up. There is a parallel world called Midworld, where Idris Elba is from, and a teen from our world has visions of this world.
Right.
Ends up going through a portal. It's a sort of standard portal fantasy sort of narrative.
Standard. Happens to me all the time.
Yep.
Can't walk on the street without falling through a portal.
Yep. There is a dark tower which apparently defends all dimensions from evil, and Matthew McConaughey wants to knock it down.
Oh, Matthew.
And let all the demons in. And Idris Elba's gunslinger character, does he want to stop the evil, or does he just want to kill Matthew McConaughey's Man in Black for revenge reasons?
Ooh.
And this is the sort of the character conflict we have going through.
Do we not know, or does he not know?
It is his central moral dilemma.
Oh, okay.
Because the Man in Black killed his father, and should he really be going after him just because he killed his father, or
prepared
should he be
die.
Going after him
classic
because
trope, killing father? It's you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another one of those movies that's quite a lot about dads. Like all the Marvel movies.
Yeah. But especially Guardians of the Galaxy. That one.
Yeah.
And also Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's entertaining enough. It's a really kind of brisk 90 minutes. So for a summer blockbuster, it's very tight and like tightly plotted and sort of not a wasted anything in it. Entertaining enough is sort of good enough for me. I've not read any of the source material. From what I know from people who have, entertaining enough is damning it with very faint praise given the caliber of the Dark Tower series.
Right, so it should have been better than it was.
Yeah.
Right.
The consensus seems to be from people who have read all of that stuff that there is material in there that is the makings of something absolutely stellar. And this is a serviceable summer blockbuster that I enjoyed.
Right.
So the
whole
thing of that is in the screenwriting world. If you've got a caliber of cast like that and a really good source material, then something happened in
the production process.
It's because it's technically skillful screenwriting in that it tells the story in the time, and the pacing is good. It keeps your attention. It's got tension. It's got stakes and all those sorts of things. It's just not anything special or out of the ordinary in terms of the story it's telling, the arcs of the characters, that kind of thing. The parallel world is nicely done. It's not your sort of like the comparison is Middle Earth from the Lord of the Rings films, which is this very like rich, sumptuous fantasy world peopled by lots of sort of interesting civilizations and strange creatures, whereas Midworld is it's a faded, fallen world.
Mm.
So it's still this very physically big sort of rolling landscapes, but it feels like sort of it's had its heyday and the colour has bled out of it and everything's a bit kind of like the vitality has faded. So it's sufficiently like different that it doesn't feel like a knockoff.
Yeah.
And it's like the world building of it is quite subtly done. We talked about Christopher Nolan came up in context of McConaughey,
mm-hmm.
And it reminded me a bit of things like Inception, in that it doesn't spend a lot of time with people sort of explaining the concepts of dimensional travel or Midworld or the Dark Tower to each other.
Right.
It's just stuff happens and there are little glancing asides and you get it.
Yeah. That's much better.
Yeah. It is, and it's skillful. The effect that it does have is it makes it feel a little bit small scale, rather than the imagination going, oh, like I can do so much with this. I have so many questions. How did this get this way?
You just end up accepting it all.
Yeah, you go, okay, oh, so that's how that fits in.
Yeah. So does that then mean it's a bit strange, potentially, that they're going to go on and do a TV series of it?
Yeah.
If you don't have a sort of hunger for more after having seen the film.
Yeah, like from a banal marketing point of view of wanting to drum up an audience for different things. If you think of the film almost as like this is the property setting out its stall and drumming up its audience for all the other things that are going to tie into it, the TV series, and they'll probably do games and all these sorts of things.
Toys.
Yeah, like I don't know whether it will fulfill that function.
Yeah.
I don't know whether people watching this who aren't already invested in the books.
And it's a series of books, isn't it?
Yes.
But they haven't committed to making a series of films.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I just think it's a bit... I think sometimes... I mean, obviously, it's a huge trend of the last few years for there to be graphic novels in particular adapted into film. But now more and more they're being adapted into huge budget TV shows on places like Netflix and Amazon Prime. And I think that is often a better way to go, actually, because with films, you are restricting yourself to, well, I've got to entertain people for 90 minutes, but then how much do you want to have them wanting more? What are we trying to channel them into? Is it the off branches of the various franchises we're setting up to promote the world, or is it the next film, which they've got to wait 3 years for?
Because often for a film, you've got to narrow it down to the main plot line or the main characters, whereas TV series, you can go for the... know other smaller characters actually creates the world a lot more than if you're just having to follow on that one story and then you kind of feel like you're
and it can depend what the creators want, whether their ambition is to make you take in every piece, to make you need to watch every movie and the TV show and read the books in order to get the full picture, or whether they're happy for if I just watch the movies and I'm not interested in the TV show, is my experience still complete as a story and as a satisfying piece of film?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was satisfied by it, but it sounds like it could have been better. So a sort of a slightly weird halfway house to be in.
Well, must try harder. Okay, well, let's move on to the final film that you're going to tell us about.
Yeah, Logan Lucky, which is Steven Soderbergh, Ocean's 11 director's return to the heist genre.
Yeah.
Except this time it's a very low-tech heist.
Yes, it is. I've seen this one as well.
Yeah. So this is... we're in West Virginia with the Logan family, Channing Tatum, Adam Driver, and...
It's probably Key, isn't it? Anyway, so, she's fab.
Yeah, she's great. Channing Tatum's Jimmy Logan is down on his luck and... drafts his family and some other people in to do a heist on a racetrack. So we're already in sort of where Ocean's 11 was all Las Vegas, glitzy casinos.
Shiny, shiny.
Everybody's in sharp suits. They've got the gadgets. They've got the cars. This one is they're robbing cash from racetrack betting tills.
Yeah.
Wearing trucker caps.
Driving pickups
and forklifts.
It's very dusty. Everywhere in the film is so dusty and warm.
Someone in the film refers to it as the hillbilly heist.
Yeah, yeah, and that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. So who's seen more stuff with Adam Driver in than me?
I don't know. How much have you
seen? So I've basically only seen him in Star Wars.
What if the... Okay. Much underrated Daniel Radcliffe rom-com.
Nice.
I saw him in that as well.
Because my question, because I feel like this does... So where Channing Tatum being in 21 Jump Street made all of us realise, hey, this handsome guy can be funny as well. I feel like this is doing a similar thing for Adam Driver. He's got a very good deadpan humour all the way through it.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
I hadn't seen from him before.
It's a really good character study, actually.
Yeah. Because a lot of his performance, so he is Clyde Logan. He is the superstitious one in the family who believes that they have bad luck throughout their blood. He's an Iraq vet. He's an amputee. But you could read him as a blank. He's very deadpan throughout.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really kind of subtle facial stuff that he's doing to give his reactions to various things. Like, it's a really kind of subtle but funny performance.
Yeah, he is very, very funny.
Yeah.
What about Daniel Craig? He was the most bizarre part of that trailer, which is the only reason I ever actually wanted to see
it.
He
is clearly having the time of his life.
Absolutely, I think he's really good in it. And, like, there were moments in it where I forgot who it was.
Yes, yeah.
So this is Daniel Craig with, like, a bleach blonde buzz cut,
yeah,
a neck tattoo of, is it the outline of West Virginia that he's got tattooed on his neck?
I mean, that sounds legit.
as Joe Bang, the demolitions guy that they have to bust out of jail in order to do the job. They have to bust out of jail and back in again without anybody noticing.
Correct.
Which is a nice twist to it.
Yeah.
So there's sort of multiple layers to the heist, as in any good heist plot.
It's a really good heist plot, actually. It's very
satisfying.
It
really is, yeah. And all the more so for being low-tech. Like, they can't call in Don Cheadle and set off an EMP and shut down all the electricity.
No.
Like, they have to be really ingenious with what they've got.
Yeah.
To
Which is not a lot. Like, yeah. They did not spend a lot of money on this heist.
Yeah, it's not a lot of outlay for these con men.
No.
I mean, we talked about Riley Keough's character, the sister. It's nice that there's a lady on the heist crew. She's the only lady on the heist crew. I think if I remember right, that puts it one up on Ocean's 11. Still not great that she's the only one.
No, and it's good that they didn't feel they had to create a whole new heist movie where they were all women in order to compensate.
What struck me was that the first act, as is standard in the heist format, the first act is Jimmy recruiting his crew. Yeah. And there are whole sort of subplots about he has to persuade Clyde to get involved when the last time he did any crime with Clyde went to jail, so that he needs some persuading. He has to persuade Joe Bang to get involved, and that means getting him out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
They even have a scene where they have to persuade Joe Bang's two brothers to get involved.
Yeah, they are brilliant.
They are great. That involves, like, their morals clause.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they need a moral reason to do the heist.
They have to feel like they're doing some good. And then Melly Logan is just doing the heist.
Yeah.
We don't get a scene where he has to recruit her. It's just like, there's a scene
family.
Where she starts doing some stuff, and you're like, oh, so she's in the crew as well, eh? Which struck me.
Yeah, she's just awesome.
I'm going to present that without comment. She is great. Especially her interactions with Jimmy's ex's new man
about cars. Yes.
She's great at boosting cars.
Yes. And he's all like, I know about cars. And she's like, yeah, you don't know about cars.
Because he's a specialist car dealer.
But he's also a mega douche.
Yeah. I felt like it was I couldn't quite get a grasp by the end on, like, what it was about other than being, like, a good, twisty, clever heist plot that hangs together.
Right.
I think there's something in that about that Channing Tatum's character, Jimmy Logan, is a bit, I use this word more than usual tonight, inscrutable. The simple justification given for him setting this whole thing up is he needs money to pay a lawyer for some family stuff. But by the end, I felt like it had sort of done a couple of twists to the point that I wasn't sure what point it was making, whether it was saying, like, oh, he's overcome his selfishness and is now putting family first, is one possible interpretation of it. But there isn't really an arc to get you there.
No, and it keeps twisting as well. The twists don't stop.
Yeah.
So you're left thinking, what's the Okay.
Yeah, so I found him hard to get a grip on as a character, and I don't think that's Channing Tatum's fault. I think it's the way it's written. Either the writing or the editing. Written by a lady, screenplay by a lady.
Yes, ladies.
Her name is, I will be with you in a second with her name.
Hold, please.
It's written by Rebecca Blunt. Yeah, so I'm not sure whether it's stuff that, whether there was important character stuff that got left on the cutting room floor, or whether he was written as a bit of a blank to begin with. But I found him a little bit hard to get my teeth into. But I think there's enough good character acting going on around him that you can overlook it, from sort of the subtle end with Adam Driver to the over-the-top end with Daniel Craig and his neck tattoos.
It's so much fun. So apparently there's some mystery surrounding Rebecca Blunt as to whether she's real.
Oh, could she be a composite?
Hopefully
she,
not of men.
Yeah, well, people are suggesting it's a pseudonym. And some people are suggesting it's a pseudonym for Soderbergh.
Oh.
I hope that's not true. I hope it's a real lady and she done writing. But there we go.
Yeah. What did you think?
I really enjoyed the film. I think I love anything that's really strong characters, and there's such a brilliant cast of characters that in itself just kept me entertained the whole way through. I thought that I'm really a big fan of heist movies and heist TV series. Big fan of Hustle when it was on the BBC. And it was really good. I think it delivered on all the kind of classic heist stuff that you would expect.
Yeah, me too. Like all the stuff that I'm saying about the slightly slippery main character and not really having a sense of what the thesis of the movie is just it's a minor criticism. As a whole, it hangs together and is fun.
So there we go. Go see Logan Lucky.
Yeah.
Lucky Logan.
No, the first one.
Okay, sure.
I'm sure if you Google both, they'll both get you there.
Yeah, for sure. And coming up, we've got quite a few films coming out. Things like Goodbye Christopher Robin, which looks like it will be beautiful if nothing else. Reese Witherspoon's back again with some kind of rom-com, Home Again. New Blade Runner is going to be coming out October. One. And then there's a bit further ahead at the end of October is Thor.
Yeah.
And then into November, we've got Paddington 2, the Justice League, Murder on the Orient Express, and Star Wars. I also want to go and see Kingsman, the Golden Circle.
Oh, yeah. More Channing Tatum.
Yes. it looks really good, actually. In case no one noticed, Vicky Weston's in the studio now.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Vicky Weston. So, we are now, though, going to be talking about all the things that Sinead's been seeing with her eyes. Maybe not all of them, but, the theatre-related ones.
Yes. So, I think last time I was here, I had about 4 or 5 theatres on my list. For those that weren't listening last time, I set myself a challenge of trying to go to all of the West End theatres in London, which no one can actually agree what those are. So, basically, I decided it was all the ones that can win an Olivier. That was kind of a basic rule.
Got to draw a line somewhere.
Draw a line somewhere. So that's 55 theatres.
Sure, seems fine.
Yep. So I'm now down to 2, which is...
That's impressive.
The one that is forever plaguing me, which is Phantom of the Opera, which I hate.
and it's not going to die anytime soon.
But it's never going to go away.
Can
so
you,
I'm
like, sedate yourself
to.
Before you go?
I've decided I'm taking my grandma. She loves it.
Oh, okay.
I'll you know, be
You could just
good.
Watch her watch it.
Yeah, I'm a good granddaughter. You know, take her along. She'll be happy and I'll just, yeah.
If anybody can suggest some Phantom of the Opera drinking game rules.
Oh, that would be great. I'd really appreciate it.
I do have some immediate thoughts.
Yeah. Okay, Set me up.
Okay, we'll do a
bonus episode or something.
Yeah, a bonus episode that's just the Phantom of the Opera drinking game.
Just a short YouTube clip of Sinead being dragged by police from the theatre.
I've seen it twice, reluctantly, and I have some thoughts.
Yeah. So that and the Royal Opera House, which I also...
So that will be less painful.
Yeah.
You have more at least you can choose what you see.
Yes, but it's opera or ballet, which are kind of the options. But the shows I've seen so far have been La Strada, which was on at what was used to be called St. James's Theatre and now is called The Other Palace, which I don't really know why they
renamed
it. Yeah, it's got a really bad logo that doesn't work. But anyway, it's...
You just look up why they've renamed it.
I'm going to look up what the logo looks like.
Yeah. I've got so many questions.
As I said, with a new theatre, it actually really works as a good. Do you agree?
Yeah, oh, the palace is terrible.
No, it is, isn't it?
It's like they did an accident.
Yeah, everyone Google the other palace right now and just marvel.
Yeah. But where they failed in their logo, their theatre space works really well.
Good.
In, you know, just having really good sight lines, it not really matching where you were. Unfortunately, it wasn't a very full space, so I booked tickets for the back row on the same day and then just got pushed forward to the front, which was kind of great.
So but good for you, bad good for the theatre.
Me, really bad for theatre in general.
Yeah.
But it was the Strada, which was actually based on a film which I'd never seen. But it's kind of circus skills, and it was directed by the same director as did Jane Eyre, which Matt actually saw at the National last year, and is coming back. And I would strongly suggest that anyone who is free should go to it because it's amazing. And
seconded.
Made us both almost cry.
Yep.
Great.
Probably actually cry. Yes. So that was brilliant. And then I'd never been to the Regent's Park open air theatre, which. Partly because I'm scared of the weather, and truth be, I went on the day and it was chucking it down all day.
Oh.
And then an hour before, completely cleared up and was
so were you
magical. No, managed to come prepared with lots of things to dry off the seat, and
great.
It was all good. And it's actually, I don't know why I hadn't been before, because it's a magical theatre space. It's there are some theatres where you have to be in a great seat, you know. For the Palace Theatre, there was absolutely no point going if you're in the nosebleed seats, because you feel like you're about a mile away from any of the action, and there's no way of being part of it. Whereas the Regent's Park, they set it so well in the fact that we were right on the edge, but I could see everything, and there's absolutely no reason to pay for, you know, the top price tickets, in my opinion. And even though it's Andrew Lloyd Webber, who I'm not a fan of, as previously stated, Phantom the Opera. It was actually really well staged. Unfortunately, Judas was a lot better than Jesus.
Oh, that's awkward.
Is, you know,
that is
it's
a better part,
though, right?
It is a definite better part. But the guy had, oh my God, his voice was amazing, and really made it like a skin tingling experience. And I would definitely go again. Next year. So that was kind of, as part of this whole trying to go to every theatre, it kind of trying to pay attention to what the theatre spaces are and which work better, and kind of the effect it can have on a production, I think is really interesting. There's definitely some of my favourite theatres that I end up, this is why it's taken me so long to do this list, is there's some that you keep on coming back to that programme really good things that work in that kind of space. And there's others that are just horrendous, I think.
Yeah.
There's, don't know whether you all agree, but we've got famous theatres.
Are you going to name the bad offenders?
There's some that work for kind of the Savoy Theatre. I really don't like. But it's got Dreamgirls at the moment, and it's very flashy. It's kind of, it's got all the bling around the Proscenium Arch, so it kind of works for that production. But I wouldn't particularly want to go to that. The Palace Theatre, as I said, I saw previous productions, and if you're far away, then you just don't feel you're in the production at all. But The Cursed Child is on there now, and it looks like Hogwarts, and it means that, you know, more people can get in to see it. And I actually, having known how bad the tickets were, got good seats, so that was fine. Comedy theatre is really, like, tall. I don't know, you feel like you're stacked up on one on top of each other.
A steep, there. Good steep rake.
It's a very steep rake.
Sometimes a blessing, sometimes a curse.
Depending where you are.
Yeah.
It's really useful to know as well, though, having been to all the theatres now, when you go to shows in future there, you'll be like, oh, well, I know not to sit here.
Well, exactly.
Because that's a terrible place to sit.
Yeah. I think that's it. Like, there are certain theatres I go to that I've been to quite a lot where I would be judicious about my seat picking.
Yeah.
But then one I've not really been to much, I'd be like...
Well, you're kind of dropping a pin in a map, really. Because
also, they say best available, but who even knows?
And sometimes they'll say restricted view, and then you're like, this is a great view.
We've been to several shows where we've gone with a restricted view ticket where we feel like we've got one of the best seats in the house, because the fact that you can see down into the wings is an advantage.
Yes.
Well, I went to The Ferryman like a couple of months ago. Amazing production, also go to see that. But it was on the back row of the stalls, which should feel far away. It's absolutely perfect. It was absolutely fine. So yeah, I think
it does depend how the stage has been designed, like how the stage for that production has been designed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And where they're playing to as well, right?
And like newer theatres, like go to the National Theatre a lot, and I don't personally think there is a bad seat in the National. Mm-hmm. I think you can go whenever and
not like the olden days where they didn't really care about what you could see on the stage.
Yeah, all the people that couldn't afford the good seats.
To upset you further by mentioning his name again, so I found out the reason that the other palace was renamed, having originally been called St James's Theatre, is because it was acquired by Andrew Lloyd Webber's Really Useful Theatres Group in 2016, and he wanted to rebrand.
Oh, he just keeps on cropping up, doesn't he?
Why? Why
is it Andrew Lloyd?
I mean, to give him, I'll say something positive about him, because him and Cameron McIntosh have entirely revolutionised the theatres in London because they pumped a lot of money that no one else has into entirely changing the theatres.
Yeah, and theatres would have closed had they not.
That's caused problems with Hamilton, which is having to delay opening because entirely rebuilt the theatre, but no one else would have done it.
I'd be so angry if I'd bought those first 2 weeks.
Luckily, we didn't.
Yeah. No, we didn't.
Yeah,
seeing it three times next year.
Good grief.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Vicky's got a problem. I'm seeing it once.
February, May and June.
When are we seeing it?
February. We're seeing it first.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Tune in for the Arts Hour that week.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm going to need a full hour just to talk about Hamilton, guys.
Am I going to have to give you the don't sing copyrighted work on the podcast warning
or
again?
Almost definitely. I already have
Can you satire a satire?
Yeah. I already have many, many of the raps down.
Oh no. Do I need to learn them in advance?
No. No, it's just me being an insane person. Yes. That is what's happening.
Oh my goodness.
I'm really excited.
Well, I'm really impressed that you've nearly completed.
It's incredible.
Your challenge.
It's genuinely incredible.
I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's been a nice thing to kind of, and a reason to stretch yourself, I think. There's a reason to not just get stuck into going to the same things. I've definitely seen productions just because I wanted to take it off the list and be glad I did.
Well, that's, that's awesome. I was just thinking, like, attending to the theatre instead of the show, like, picking based on the theatre instead of the show is just a really interesting way of suddenly changing your perspective on what it is you're going to,
which
you're going
in
to
London
do.
is probably less usual, whereas like regional theatres, people will just go time and again to their local theatre because it's the nearest one. Like my parents frequent the basically all the theatres in Hampshire on a regular basis, and it's not always about, you know, obviously they try and go see shows they think they're going to like, but more often than not, it's like, well, we haven't been for a while, so let's just go to the theatre.
And
it's
see
not...
what's on, and it's wrapped.
So, good. Anyway, the last thing we wanted to ask you about was your experience of the Fringe this year, because unlike the rest of us who sat and chatted about it, you actually went up there.
Yes, I did my classic doing 12 shows in 2 days.
Yeah, that seems fine.
Yep. Because, you know, I feel if you're there, you may as well
just feel yourself. Yeah.
Oh, man.
How did you find it? What did you see that was good? What,
was
anything terrible?
Excellent. Do you know what? I didn't have any truly horrendous shows this year. I'm a little bit disappointed. Because they're always funny stories.
I feel like you've seen one stinker, haven't you?
Yeah. Like 2 years, I had to generally run out of a curry house because it was that bad and I had to vomit down the stairs, and that was my highlight of the Fringe that year. So the fact I didn't have one of those is a little bit disappointing. I think the problem with the Fringe is that the really popular shows, more and more I found over the last few years, you have to book them up in advance, which is a shame because that's not really how I like to do the Fringe. I like to get the feeling as to what's happening.
It takes the spontaneity out of it, but even a couple of years ago, me and Vicky found that we had to book in the kind of things we thought we probably wanted to see because they were already filling up.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the way I did it was on the first day, I mostly did comedy, which is far more, I feel, that you kind of know what's going to be good from that. So I saw James A. Caster, which is good because I planned to see him for about 3 years, and every year it got booked
up. We saw him at the Fringe 2 years ago, and he was amazing.
Ostentatious, which is improvised Austin. And that also, actually, my theme of the Fringe was a lot of naked.
Yeah.
Including in Ostentatious.
They get their kit off quite a lot in Ostentatious, I've heard.
Yeah. He definitely, him just with a top hat, it was special.
Oh, was it on his head?
Or his head.
Yes, well, that's...
Oh, God.
He knew what it meant. Anyway.
Explain to Duke Norma.
Shakespeare for breakfast, which is kind of like a
terrible croissants though.
Yeah,
don't go for the breakfast.
No, they have to bulk buy them. Yeah, but you know, it's a way of the problem is there is never a good morning show, because everyone who is a fringe tends to like to go for the afternoon. So trying to find something for the morning slot is quite difficult. Police Cops in Space, which might be one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. It's by the Pretend Men. Last year they did Police Cops, that was in a, it's a double with Max in a Van, and they're also a kind of sketch, but got a kind of running story that's tenuous. But it worked very well as a kind of double with Max in a Van. It's that kind of theme. And this year it was Police Cops in Space. And it's very inventive with their props.
I might have to try and find them if they're doing stuff in London.
I think they did just a couple of days recently. But yes, if you have a chance to see them, they're excellent. I mean, their energy, as much as anything, is quite impressive because they throw themselves across the stage. And then the second day, I tried to get a few more recommendations, which was difficult. There wasn't really as much of a buzz about things, and a lot of the shows that I'd kind of companies that I usually go and see weren't doing shows this year. But The Good Girl, which actually was one of those things that I sat down and realised it was a Royal Holloway
criteria. Amy Sheldon?
Yes, it was. Yes! Amy Sheldon. And
it's fantastic.
It was brilliant. It was in the Mash House, the attic space, so classic fringe venue of being in the eaves and just being absolutely boiling. But it's kind of her talking through her growing up and things of depression and sexuality, but kind of talking through them with characters and the friends that she had, and it was truly excellent, one of the best things I saw.
I'm hoping she gets a London run. I'd really like to go and see it.
Yeah, I think she should. It did really well. It was one of the pay what you want kind of things, and I think she got still a lot did
of
really
famos
well.
Going to see it. Lots of famous people.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what The Fringe is good for, with word of mouth. I truly believe that was one of the shows that would do well for things. And then, yeah, a couple of other kind of just little sweet things. There was a thing called The Heart of the Sea, which just had this amazing box that kept on developing into new scenery with mini puppets.
Oh, I love
things.
A multi-purpose set.
I know.
I mean, that is our fave. Yeah. And that is like legit our fave.
Yeah. And there was a good use of looping. I saw a fair number of things with musicians and loop pedals.
I love a bit of that as well. Very clever.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was great. And Four Alarms and Hog was the last show I saw, which is also an Irish sketch comedy group, who they release a new sketch online every week.
Oh, writing them down
and,
as well.
Yeah, which are very funny. So I had a great time. And The Sun came out, which also doesn't happen at the Fringe. So that's nice for the brief minutes that I was not seeing a show. I could have a drink. In
it sounds
garden.
Like you had a dream of a Fringe.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Lovely. All right. Well, I think we'll probably have to regrettably leave the Fringe behind us for this year now. Are we going to close the book on the Fringe for 2017?
Probably.
I think so.
Shame.
We'll start ramping up to next year.
It makes me sad.
So, Vicky, there's a lot of theatre going on this episode.
So much theatre. I'm loving it.
But you are very enthusiastic about having seen Girl from the North Country at the Old Vic. Tell us about it.
Oh, my gosh. Speaking of great theatres, right, I love the Old Vic. I love
agree.
That theatre. Apart from the loo situation downstairs, it's an absolute nightmare.
Is it?
Because it basically it's basically predicated on the assumption that there will never be a queue for the ladies' toilet.
Sure, but I mean there never is.
At the theatre. I mean, come on, guys. But no, it's a wonderful theatre. They had a refurb and it looks incredible. There's an absolutely epic like light installation down the staircase. Mm. It's just awesome. Seats are super comfortable, it's well air conditioned. What more can you want? So I went to see Girl from the North Country, which is quite an extraordinary piece of theatre for several reasons. So for anyone that doesn't know, Girl from the North Country is a Bob Dylan musical.
Sure.
Three words that don't often really go together. And Girl from the North Country is a pretty famous Bob Dylan track. It's an absolutely fantastic song. I urge you to check it out. Basically, this show is like, it's Bob Dylan songs, so you kind of go in thinking it's like a jukebox musical, right? Where they are going to string a story together with Bob Dylan songs about a girl from the North Country, right?
Sure.
It seems like, I mean, that's how Mamma Mia works, that's how We Will Rock You works, like, this is what's going to happen.
Works. We Will Rock You works.
Sure. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, you know.
Tenuous.
But yes, that's what
you'd expect.
That's the system. Or the alternative being, of course, that when you find out that it's going to be set in Duluth, Minnesota, birthplace of Bob Dylan, that maybe the show will be about Bob Dylan's life.
Yeah.
And then have songs like, as he writes them, like, for example, the musical Beautiful, the Carole King musical.
Sure.
These are two, like, tried and tested methods of introducing songs
into... You've got,
into...
like, a little map, and they're your two branches of where you can go.
They are the possible options. Or are they?
I'm thinking maybe not.
No, they're not the only possible options. And Conor McPherson, who wrote Girl from the North Country, decided to do something completely different and basically uses the songs as almost like a soundtrack for the show, but they mostly, the songs represent things that are in characters' heads.
Ah, cool.
And the way that he talks about it in the program, because I went with my dad for his birthday, so we got a program. It's very exciting.
Treats.
Yeah, I know. It's a really nice program, actually. And it's small, not like a giant, massive program. It's like sort of less than A4 size. He talks about how he wanted the relationship between the words, the text, the play text, and the songs to be like a conversation between. And I was like, pretentious. That was my first thought. And then it started and I was like, oh, yeah, this is, that's what he's done. And it's really, really clever. And for a while, I found it a little discombobulating because as an audience member...
Combobulating?
Yeah. Like, that was a really good joke. I didn't even know I made it. gosh, I wish I'd thought of that in advance. But it was a little discombobulating because I think when you're so used to it being like, it's a biopic musical or it's a jukebox musical, that you are trying to just really make the songs fit. And you're like, okay, what's the meaning of them singing like a Rolling Stone at this point? And it's like, that's not the way to watch the show. And as soon as I'd kind of just embraced this concept, it all just started making sense. And it is incredibly stylish. It's really, really beautiful. They use an incredible range of Bob Dylan songs, sometimes in medley, sometimes as just massive kind of belting numbers with one character stood at the front, just absolutely killing it. Sometimes it's just like a little refrain that you hear, like that's really how Girl from the North Country, the song itself, is kind of featured in the show. So you get the full range of kind of possible like musical avenues for how you would use a song in a show. The musicians are all on stage, which is a thing I love about newer musicals. That happens in Once. They did it in the new production of Fiddler on the Roof. Like, I think it works really, really well. Some of them are musicians who are there all the time, and some of them are sometimes characters that pick up a musical instrument and play for a bit and then kind of swap over. There are some really great kind of medleys and mashups of Bob Dylan songs, which work extremely well. Like, the whole soundtrack is just an absolute treat. And because we went with my dad for his birthday, we took my mum along. My dad is a huge Bob Dylan fan, lifelong Bob Dylan fan, which is partly why I picked the show. But my mum loves and hates Bob Dylan because she thinks he can't sing. And you know what? She's kind of right.
Especially in later years.
Oh my goodness, the dude is struggling. But he is an incredible poet, he's an incredible musician, he's an incredible storyteller. And watching his songs be performed by people with absolutely extraordinary voices was a real treat in and of itself. Besides from the fact that the show, the play, if you will, because I'm hesitant to call it a musical, the play is an incredibly stylish exploration of the life of a small family living in Duluth, Minnesota during the Great Depression, who, you know, and basically are kind of losing everything in this really kind of like harsh winter environment. And it deals with race a little bit, which is great because that's the kind of things that feature in Bob Dylan's music. It deals with gender a bit. It deals with themes like dementia and aging and death and suicide.
Oh God, all the things.
Yeah, so many things. And that's partly because these are all things that have been explored in Bob Dylan tracks. And then those songs are used in the show. So it's a real kind of harmony between great performances, great songs written by Bob Dylan, a really, really interesting play in and of itself, and some absolutely standout performances. Shirley Henderson is in it, and she's kind of the protagonist, if you will, but not really. She plays a character, a mother with dementia. She is famous for being Moaning Myrtle in Harry Potter.
I was going to say that's who I think she is.
And my goodness, does she have a set of pipes.
Mm.
Not the pipes that she inhabits in Harry Potter, but the singing kind.
She's Scottish.
Yeah. And she does not only a completely spot on Minnesotan accent, like it's so specifically well studied, but then she absolutely blows you away with incredible vocal performances as well. There are a whole range of incredible vocal performances, but she was the one I found the most surprising, partly because she's so tiny.
She is diddy.
And I'm always amazed when a giant voice comes out of a tiny, tiny person. Kieran Hines is in it, and he's kind of, he plays Shirley Henderson's husband. He is famous for being Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones, amongst other classic roles. He is an extraordinary stage actor. He has such stage presence, and yeah, he's just an incredible watch. There are a couple of other kind of well-known people who you'll look at and go, oh, who's that? Oh, it's somebody who's a kind of regular bit part in things. And then also some people who are younger, more up-and-coming performers who have done a lot of kind of fringy off West End stage work who are being featured in the show. So it's just like all round, like, really strong recommendation for anyone to go and see it. If you're a hesitant Bob Dylan fan, I would still encourage you to go and see it. If you're a Coen Brothers fan, I feel like this would be stylistically a kind of show for you. And if you are a Bob Dylan fan, then you should absolutely go and see it. There's just one like really interesting thing that I want to mention about it, aside from how fantastic the show was, which is that they have been trying to do a Bob Dylan musical for a really long time. Like,
oh, really?
It's a thing they have tried to do before, and it's just never worked. And I read a really interesting article in Rolling Stone magazine, aptly named, about the musical, and they were talking about these kind of past failures of trying to do a Bob Dylan musical. And partly that's been because it's been incredibly difficult to get Bob Dylan involved in making it happen.
To get the rights.
To get the rights, all that kind of thing. Although he loves the theatre and has always been very passionate about the theatre, so was in theory in favour of doing a musical of some sort. There was then a show, I think in the 70s or 80s, that had like a 3-week run and closed because it just didn't, like, it just was a total failure. And I think people have been kind of suggesting that it really feels like Conor McPherson just kind of cracked this code of like what it took to do a show that had the style and elegance of the music of Bob Dylan. And when they provided Bob Dylan with the script backstage at a show in 2013, I think, he took one look at it and was like, yeah, this is the right, like, this feels like the right story to tell.
This is the one I've been waiting
for. Yeah, this is the one I've been waiting for. And I can imagine that being like the most perfectly like Bob Dylan experience of him doing that. And then he basically, him and Sony, who are his record label, gave permission to use the entire back catalogue. So any song Bob Dylan had ever written was up for grabs for this show.
He really liked the script.
Yeah. So Conor McPherson, who like said he was like a fan, but like a super fan, then spent ages kind of trawling through Dylan's back catalogue. And that's why there are a number of songs in there that
are lesser known.
Consider myself to be a pretty serious Bob Dylan fan. And so does my dad. Like, he's a like lifelong Bob Dylan fan. But there were definitely songs in there we were like, huh, didn't know he did this song.
It must be a B-side.
Like, where the heck does this come from? So that was like a really nice, like, as a Bob Dylan fan, it's a really nice experience to see something that felt like, it really felt like Bob Dylan, like, it, you know, texturally and stylistically, and yet Bob Dylan features not at all in it, and it happens completely before Bob Dylan was born, but his music fits it perfectly, even though obviously this music comes from the 60s and this is set in the 30s. It just absolutely works beautifully. So it's on until the beginning of October
7th.
Well done. And there are still tickets available, and I urge people to go and see it.
Yes.
I sat in the stalls and it was an excellent view.
You fancy pants.
Yeah. Well, I bought my tickets on a ticket purchasing app, which I probably shouldn't be naming on a podcast.
Yes, you can.
Can I do it?
No one sponsors it.
We're okay.
The
BBC.
It's okay. So I bought my tickets on TodayTix 2 days before.
Yeah.
I love a bit of TodayTix. Yeah. 2 days or 3 days before we went to see it, because I had left it to the last minute to sort out something to do for my dad's birthday, and was like, this looks good. So it was all on a bit of a whim, and our tickets were like £30 each.
Which
and
we, stalls is really
and
good,
we sat in the stalls, and it felt very close. the performances are very intimate, and I always think that having the musicians like performing on the stage brings everything closer together. So it really is a great experience. I think they are talking about taking it to the US.
I imagine it would do pretty well.
You would think it would. But it's like, it was an extraordinary piece of like new writing, and you don't see many, I feel like I haven't seen many musicals of late that are new writing that's really doing something different with like the musical genre. Like, I've seen great new musicals. Like, I think Book of Mormon's a great example of a fantastic new musical, but it really is.
To some extent, it's formulaic.
Yeah, it really does. Like, genre. And that's intentional because then they're kind of doing a parody. So it makes sense, but this was really something different. And I was like, this may be a kind of groundbreaking moment for the way that we see plays and music and musicals
It's really interesting. It's just
boundaries.
Reminding me of working on Little Voice, because that is a play with music. It's not a musical. And it sounds like this is treading the same kind of line.
Yeah,
like, it's
absolutely.
Not like,
yeah.
It's not like characters suddenly burst into song together necessarily every time the song happens.
Yeah.
All the lights go pretty.
But it's
really part of the narrative.
Yeah, and it feels more like almost like the soundtrack. And that worked brilliantly. So it was an absolutely brilliant show, and I would recommend anybody to get tickets to it and go and see it, because it's and take some tissues, for the love of God, take tissues.
Sounds totes emotion.
Yeah, it is.
Well, thank you very much for running us through what sounds like a fantastic show. I'm very quickly gonna just wrap up and remind everyone that the next thing that Blackshaw is doing in the theatre arena is going to be the Scare Slam. So if you know what a poetry slam is, it's like that, but with scary stories.
Ooh.
That's right. Yeah. So it's happening as part of London Horror Festival. Tickets are now on sale. What?
Exciting.
Yes. That is exciting.
So you can find them just going to, if you go to the London Horror Festival website, you can find them very easily. And we are tweeting and Facebooking about it as well. Tickets are only £10 or £8 concession, which is a bargain for the night that you're going to have. It's on Monday, 23rd of October at 7 p.m. at the Old Red Lion, which is the venue for the whole festival. And it's essentially a night of chilling storytelling, which is going to be compared by me.
Consider it your Halloween warm-up.
Indeed. So,
or chill down. Oh. Shiver at the Halloween-ness.
Chain noises. So come on down if you fancy a scare, or if you'd like to take part and contribute a story, which you can perform yourself, or if you're too scared to do that, you can have a performative friend do it for you. You can just go onto our blog now. So if you just search for Blackshaw Theatre, you'll find us. But you need to know that it's 5 minutes maximum per piece. Notes can be used. They are solo readings of scary stories or anecdotes. You can only submit your own writing. We encourage writers to read their own works, but writer people can work with an actor if they prefer. And there's no tech requirements, because we are providing a spooky atmosphere. And submissions need to come to us. It's submissions@blackshawonline.com by Friday the 6th of October. So you've got a bit of time to crack on with that. So,
a couple of weeks.
That's very exciting.
It is very exciting. Yeah. So hopefully we'll be seeing lots of you lovely listeners in person. And I can scare you with both intense eye contact and hilariously scary comparing skills.
Yes,
that's right.
Have you got a new scary anecdote for this year?
I've been thinking about that, because I did tell a couple last time,
and they are the really good ones.
They are the really good
you
ones.
Got out the gold.
But I think if I dig deep, I can probably recall some buried traumatic event from my childhood involving a ghost.
I mean, of any time that would be the right time to share a buried traumatic event from your childhood in front of an audience at the Old Red Lion is the time to
while
do
it's
it.
Being recorded for the podcast. Ideal. So if you want to come and see me have a breakdown on stage, then this is the time to do it. I hope I will see you all there through my blurry tears. Anything else anyone would like to say about the Scare Slam? Well done there.
Yeah, well done.
Blurry tears sums it up, I think.
Yeah.
I'm going to go cry for a little warm-up cry now. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. It's goodbye from me, Ellie. I'm waving at the microphone right now.
Why don't we all do that? I'm going to do that too.
Bye. Bye from all of us. Good night.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.